This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 138 of Culture with me, Robert Bound. The show today is all about my second favourite sort of strip, the comic. In print and on the big screen, the pace, immediacy and universality of the comic strip and the comic book character is a potent piece of culture. From Gotham City's Batman to Japanese manga via Iran's Persepolis, comics get under our skin, inform and entertain, get ultra-violent, moralistic and quite sexy too. Someone say strip? So from left to right in our panel of fast-moving action scenes is this lot. We'll take a trip to the weird and wonderful, and did we mention weird, world of Comic-Con, the love-in for superhero worshippers.
TX11386. It's my designation, man.
We'll meet the people who took Batman to Japan and therefore made Batmanga.
As a Batman fan, to me it was like finding a great Beatles record that had been recorded on tour in Japan and then kind of like shelved and then never released.
And we'll speak to Monocle regular film buff Karen Krasanovich and ask why Hollywood is enthralled to men in tights and girls in capes.
Comics have everything that a good film needs. Excitement, straightforward stories, has heroes, has villains, has people that need saving, has inspiration, and it's easy to follow.
Plus, we'll speak to the political speechwriter who turned his time at the French Foreign Ministry into a hilarious best-selling graphic novel. We'll go to Kenya to see how comics teach a valuable lesson. And a live Midori House session from Jeremy Messersmith will ensure that no foot is left untapped. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Hailing from Minneapolis, Jeremy Messersmith is a man whose time has surely come. Treading a line between bittersweet balladry and exquisitely crafted optimistic pop, he's sounding in fine form on his fourth album, Heart Murmurs. From it, here he is with Ghost.
One more night in Omaha, bus stop just before the dawn, cold wind followed me somehow. Through parking lots and shopping malls, rinse my thoughts in alcohol. Black clouds rolling over me. And if there is a line, I'll cross it. No lesson will I learn. Even if I'm standing on it, no bridge that I won't burn. Coming back to where we started, I'm only passing through. I've become a ghost in your garden, fading into view. Broke my heart with sticks and stones, swore I'm never coming home. Last words never written down. Been so long since I've been gone, doubt if you'll know me at all. Down did I make you proud? And if there is a line, I'll cross it. No lesson will I learn. Even if I'm standing on it, no bridge that I won't burn. Coming back to where we started, I'm only passing through. I've become a ghost in your garden, fading into view. Day is short, my shadow's long. One more hour till Wichita sunlight never felt so kind. And if there is a line, I'll cross it. No lesson will I learn. Even if I'm standing on it, no bridge that I won't burn. Coming back to where we started, I'm only passing through. I've become a ghost in your garden, fading into view.
And that was Jeremy Messersmith with Ghost. More of him later on Culture with me, Robert Bound. And we're all about comics on today's Culture Show, but it's such a vast world of otherworldliness. Where to start? Maybe the best place is speaking to someone that can put the vital relationship between Hollywood and comics into context. Nothing is more reliable to bust blocks in the arena of the blockbuster than superheroes saving the day while, more often than not these days, gazing at their spandex-covered navels. Monocle's regular film expert, Karen Krasanovich, flew in to sort the Iron Men from the Supermen.
Hollywood has been in love with comics since movies began. I mean, Superman appeared back in, you know, Republic films back in the 40s, and that's just the start. It's almost impossible for me to get across a shorthand of Hollywood's association with comic books. And that's simply because comics have everything that a good film needs. It has excitement, has straightforward stories, has heroes, has villains, has people that need saving, has inspiration, and it's easy to follow. So it's not just for the intellectual people, it's also for the cheap seats. And that means that Hollywood can sell the story to a lot of people.
Spider-Man is no longer just Spider-Man, he's the Amazing Spider-Man. Now, this summer, he's the Amazing Spider-Man 2. Andrew Garfield is the Amazing Spider-Man 2. That, you know, he cometh again, like the Iceman, maybe. We confuse, don't we, hi-fi acts, we earn lots of money, should I say, and superheroes. I wonder how closely they've always been related. As he said, these are guys for the cheap seats to cheer on as much as anyone else.
Hollywood didn't really appreciate the superhero, I think, really, until two things happened. We ended up having amazing franchises like Batman, which earned an enormous amount of money. Superman didn't do too badly either. And also the demise of the studio selling other kinds of films. And that is because films were no longer able to compete on the event level as they used to be. For example, a James Bond film would come out. James Bond himself is a bit of a superhero.
Yeah.
And everybody would go. And that's because you couldn't see the film again. It was either on the big screen and you saw it there, or you couldn't see it anywhere else. So that was kind of a perfect storm where they saw their salvation in the superhero genre and they decided to pump their money into it.
We talked about the necessary ingredients for a great story, and heroes and villains and a story arc that kind of makes sense and it's not too existential. Although nowadays the angst creeps in. Batman films are like watching Samuel Beckett. It's not, is it? But, you know, we'll say, we'll keep that in. You know, this is something that goes actually back to the source, isn't it? I mean, in Christopher Reeve's days, there's a man that flew around and without complication other than the bit of kryptonite, there wasn't much troubling him. Whereas presumably in the source, the old comics themselves, they're quite dark. Batman is a is a dark thing. Gotham, clearly, as the word sounds, is all about that. Do you think it was only a matter of time before the darkness crept into these comics?
I think the darkness goes along with sort of societal problems. And for example, if you had Captain America or Superman back in the days of America, World War II, that was very, very different, very patriotic, very strong, not scared of a lot. Where now it's a darker, less certain time, and the superheroes have to reflect that. But a lot of people have noticed, whether subconsciously, unconsciously, that the superheroes that we have actually go along with Greek myths. For example, Superman is Zeus. Hades is Batman, Poseidon, Aquaman, etc. And I think that there are a lot of archetypes that embed themselves into our superheroes, the superheroes that we love the most. And those are cultural identifiers. So this is not just guys that wear braces and don't have any friends sitting in their house reading comic books, as it used to be. It's now people really understanding the cultural memes and getting them through this medium.
I was interested that you made the link to Greek myth there. Something that I was thinking about, that these are stock characters from time immemorial that kind of crop up, and whether they're wearing spandex or whether they're wearing a toga. Did Greek gods wear togas, I think?
Or maybe
they sort of togas when they're sort of Charlton Heston as Zeus.
Well, when they're on camera, they wear togas, but otherwise I don't think they
otherwise bother. I think they're fine.
Well, they're perfect, so.
They're perfect, they don't need it. But I wonder whether it is that need to tell these sort of same sort of stories. It's the same story arcs. It's quest. It's saving the damsel in distress. It's all about, presumably, love and saving the world.
Well, it is. I mean, we can ask ourselves even a meta question, if you like. Why do we listen to music? Why do we read books? Why do we look at comic books? Why do we see films? Why do we talk to each other? I don't know. Well, why?
I think we're getting paid to.
It's because stories are important to us. Stories are important to mankind, whether it's the Caves of Lascaux or the latest film down at the Multiplex. Stories are how we learn about other people's lives and how to fulfill our own worries or our own destinies, I suppose. And stories inform us, and we're always interested, even if we don't think we are. So superheroes give us the hints at how we can solve problems in our lives. I'm not saying that you should fly around the building if you have, if you're having an argument with your wife, but there are elements in these films and in the comics that are actually very informative and psychologically useful. Don't forget, comic book writers are often incredibly sensitive people, and Hollywood hires the best writers and the best artisans possible to tell us stories. There's no way that we can miss what they're trying to say, even if the guys with the money stop them from saying exactly what they want.
I wonder whether you can put a vague date or maybe a movie title on when the rehabilitation of movies made on comic strips. Maybe Tim Burton's Batman, or whether it was before that. Because the Superman films, those Christopher Reeve Superman films, seem pretty simplistic kind of superhero movies. Was there a tipping point? Was there a movie at which kind of these almost children's characters took on the trials and tribulations of the adult world?
Well, I think Tim Burton's Batman, and I think 1989,
yeah,
new design of a Batmobile. In fact, I knew the guy that designed it. And we were excited because the Batman that as an American that we grew up with, I don't know if you have it here, was the camp Bruce Wayne, Adam
West.
Yeah, it
was Adam West, yeah.
Which was wonderful.
Bam, crash,
exactly.
Kapow.
I used to think I could read when I read those because I got it all wrong as a kid. But we thought he was just going to be cheesy and upright. But this was a Batman that was conflicted, He had sexual desires. Robin was more interesting. And it was just a darker, sexier, hotter world. And Jack Nicholson would kill you.
That was Karen Krasanovich, Monocle's regular film expert on the rise and rise of the superhero. We all know, or at least we can all guess, that working in diplomacy must be a rather entertaining affair. No lack of juicy stories when you're in charge of getting countries to get along. But would you go as far as writing a comic book about it? When, say, you're a speechwriter for France's foreign minister, Dominique de Villepin, at a time when France is under international scrutiny for having said non to the Iraq war. Well, that's what Antonin Baudry, Villepin's former employee and currently France's cultural advisor to the US, has done. His comic book, Quai d'Orsay, the name of France's foreign ministry, Country retraces his years there with humour and quite a bit of sarcasm. The story has even been turned into a film, The French Minister. And the weirdest thing is that Baudry hasn't gotten himself in trouble for it. He even gave up his pen name last year after receiving France's highest comic book award at the Angoulême Festival. Antonin, join me from our New York bureau.
When I was hired by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, I knew nothing about diplomacy. I was hired as a speechwriter, so I was just able to write. That was the only thing I could do. I didn't know these people, these guys, and so I started to see them as superheroes because they all seemed to have a special power. There was a guy who was able to understand everything in advance. There was a guy who was able to make everybody laugh. There was a guy who was able to make everybody very tense, whatever. So I started to see it as a comic book in my head. And I took the decision to tell this story as a comic book 5 years later when I was in another country. And I thought, why not make the people discover this place where people work so much and are so intense?
And I love the way that they almost seem to be superhero kind of characteristic. Everybody had a particular skill or a particular superpower, maybe. The center of the universe for you and for your story is Dominique de Villepin, the French foreign minister. Tell us a bit about your relationship with him, because it was for him for whom you were writing speeches in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I was a student in a school specializing in literature. So that was my only ability to be able to write. But we had a kind of father and son relationship that we still have, by the way, and we are still very, very close. And yeah, for me, this guy was really fascinating. But in the book, it's a fiction, so I take the liberty to really invent things, or more exactly, to give my version of the people and the things I saw. I don't pretend to be objective, but I pretend to be sincere with what I felt and what I saw. And so this main character, the minister, is for me amazing because he's both super smart and really, in a way, crazy. And it makes him do things that nobody else would have done and that, from my point of view, had to be done. And, for example, to resist to the US for the Iraq crisis and war was something that required a certain courage or even craziness in France by this time. And I think it was necessary to do so. But if he hadn't been a little crazy, I think we would have gone to this war in Iraq. And I think it would have been a mistake. So it's a kind of complex relationship with what's good and what's bad that I wanted to show in this book.
And tell me about the idea, I mean, the comic strip itself. I know that you said in interviews that you'd fancy writing novels in the past. This seemed to maybe be a bridge to be able to put your characters and your storylines down in quite a linear way. Is that fair to say? Can the comic strip be a bit of a ladder for you between speech writing and novels?
I don't know, actually, because I mean, I could have written a novel directly. It's even easier because mm-hmm. you're alone and you do whatever you want. I wanted to do this as a comic book because, first, a lot of the things I wanted to show and tell are really visual. And it's really body language, and it's really attitude, and it's really images. So I thought a novel would be nice, but it would be a lot of sentences for just one image could describe so easily. So I thought really a comic book would be good for that. And also, comic books are part of a more popular culture. And I thought it was a story about showing how behind the scene of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is a kind of secret place in France and all that, I wanted to give the opportunity to broader audience to discover how it works, how people take decisions, how rational and personal matters intersect and interact. And I thought comic book is nice for that because, a lot of people who don't really read a lot of novels or whatever about this, they like a comic book.
That was Antonin Baudry, and his comic book Quai d'Orsay is available in English under the title Weapons of Mass Diplomacy, and it is highly recommended.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more, but I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. For one weekend last month, the XL Centre in East London was jam-packed with comic fans, fans of Asian pop culture, people who like video games, people who like watching said people play video games. It's a thing, apparently. And those who enjoy all things one might deem a little geeky. This is London's Comic Con, a biannual event that draws square-eyed gamers and pale-skinned comic readers out of their bedrooms to dress up as their favourite characters, socialise with their peers and meet their heroes. Comic-Con is a term used for the events like this held independently all around the world. The largest is in San Diego, but London is quickly catching up. Monocle's Holly Fisher drew on her best manga eyes, pulled her pants up over her tights, and jumped onto a tube full of superheroes and cartoon characters to find out what on earth goes down at these events.
I assume that one is supposed to feel a sense of relief at the sight of Spider-Man, but perhaps not for the fact that he's the only recognisable face in the room. This is my first ever Comic-Con experience, and I'm slightly overwhelmed. Comic-Con London receives over 100,000 visitors during its 3-day stint, and a high percentage are in costume. Of those I can name, I confess, not many. A Superman, some Disney princesses, a couple of Pokemon, and a TARDIS. Even Star Wars R2-D2 makes an appearance. And he's brought along a couple of stormtroopers too.
TX-11386. It's my designation, ma'am.
I'm surrounded by superfans, donning some rather impressive costumes, and wielding homemade weaponry that could take out a small family. These people have obviously been rolling up their sleeves and getting a bit crafty.
Well, my hammer's made out of things like foam and cardboard, as well as paper and loads of PVA glue and impact adhesive and hardboard and lots of other things I can find around the house.
This is made out of foam and then covered in a hard, durable plastic and obviously sprayed over top of that.
Well, first I bought a kid's play tunnel from IKEA, and then those hanging baskets. There's LEDs underneath the Hessian, which we put in, and the head's basically chicken wire.
And for their efforts, they look pretty convincing. Now, I'm not entirely sure who these people are meant to be, but thank God I'm not the only one.
Oh boy, the thing is there's so many costumes and they're so complex, some of them. The problem is knowing what the characters are, so you can see some beautiful costumes and you don't know what they are.
That's Brian Cooney. He's co-organiser of the event. So far I've been slightly baffled by the sheer amount of what's on offer. As a Comic-Con beginner, I was expecting mostly comics, with a side of gaming, and maybe a bit of Doctor Who. I mean, come on, this is Britain. But actually the Comic Village is just one corner of the whole affair. From the Candy Pink Pop Asia Arena to talks on online web series at the VidFest section to an abundance of memorabilia and merchandise, minor celebrity signings and something called steampunk. So far there's been a lot to take in.
You look for what people are watching or doing themselves and then you try to incorporate it, but you have to incorporate it at a rate that you can manage it. It's not always easy and we don't always get it right.
Still slightly unsure as to what it is. I can't quite work out if they've nailed it. The smaller, more interesting independent comic book stands are hidden behind towering Nintendo video game exhibits, and the Pop Asia section seems to be mostly selling pastel-coloured wigs and sweets. But that doesn't seem to matter to the people here. For the fans, Comic-Con serves a greater purpose.
People know each other off of the internet, social media. They don't see each other, so they use this as an opportunity to get together. This is their gathering. It's a gathering of like-minded people.
And he's right. The mood in the room is excitable, and everyone seems to connect through the characters they're dressed as. Strangers embrace. The feeling of camaraderie is strong.
I think it's a way to openly showcase what you like. I've met people, became friends with them for over 2 years since I've started and things like that. And it just brings people closer because they share an interest that commonly isn't normally shared out in the wider world.
And it spreads to the exhibitors too.
I've always come to the conventions from the 80s and the 90s, and I'm surprised how much it's changed. It's actually got better now. We see all these weird and wonderful costumes. There's more of a buzz.
Martin Griffiths is a freelance illustrator for comic heavyweights such as DC and Marvel. Today, he's sketching the likes of Spider-Man and X-Men for the crowds to take home with them.
I just like coming along. It's a couple of days of escapism, getting away from home. It's a solitary job that we do, and it's nice to come to here and be appreciated for what you do.
And he's not the only one who wants to be appreciated.
Let's go!
The day ends with the UK qualifiers for the 2014 Euro Cosplay Championships that will take place later this year. Cosplay is dressing up and acting like a fictional character, and around 50 people are nervously waiting backstage to try their luck. Something that resembles a mermaid crossed with a lizard sashays on stage, dragging a 3-metre tail behind her. Uniformed schoolgirls dance to K-pop, and Superman has a rather dramatic performance, much to the pleasure of an adoring audience. There's even an alarmingly huge winged creature.
And coming on stage next, we have Emu, who's here as Feral Chaos from Final Fantasy Dissidia.
Brian Cooney tells me that next year they hope to grow the event to 160,000 visitors. And after seeing the dedication in the outfits and the passion from fans, I'm sure that's attainable. Comic-Con takes the online offline, and this is what keeps the crowds returning.
There's always going to be a need to touch and feel things and products and comic books. It can't all be digital.
And just for one final blast of weird as I leave the Exile Centre, I observe a motley crew of Spartans, Superman and various anime protagonists dancing together by a DJ stage, while someone walks past holding a sign bearing the sentence, "Kiss me, I'm desperate." Thanks, but no thanks. It's home time. For Monocle in London, I'm Holly Fisher.
Thank you very much, Holly, and you can untuck your cape from your knickers now. Still to come in part two, we'll speak to the artist who turned war reporting into a comic book, go to Kenya to see how speech bubbles and thought boxes can teach, and we'll learn what Batman got up to on his holiday in Japan. Plenty more to come, all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First up, let's meet the man behind this week's Midori House session, Jeremy Messersmith. As well as performing a few tracks for us from his new album Heart Murmurs, he sat down to shoot the breeze with Monocle's Paul Noble.
When I see you crying, if your tears run out, I will lasso you a thundercloud. And when you're tired of trying, I won't stay away. I don't care what other people say.
Let's talk about your album, Heart Murmurs. This is your fourth album. How was the process of writing and creating this for you?
Oh, painful and horrible. And it channeled as much heartbreak and hurt and angst as I possibly could into it. So in a way, it was quite therapeutic for me. I mean, I had the idea that I wanted to write a record of love songs because some of my previous records, I read some reviews and people were like, this is a cool record, but why is he writing about death and stuff, you know? So I wanted to do something kind of classic, you know? And so I sat down and started writing what I thought were love songs and wrote just a bunch of horrible ones, and they were just awful and trite. And then I was like, I'm going to have to really, really dig a little deeper and see if I can come up with something maybe that hasn't already been sung about. And it took about 2 years to kind of write everything and then finish the record.
And what was the key that unlocked it for you?
The key was really trying to find things that spoke to me personally. So it wasn't about writing, you know, kind of like what I thought people wanted to hear about love, but it was about love that I've experienced in my life. And a lot of times that was, you know, that can be heartbreak as well. And I don't know. I think it turned out okay. I think I know less about love now than I did when I started, but I think that's okay.
So you've got a tour coming up with your band. You've had a solo tour in the UK, just you and a guitar. But I want to talk about something you did a couple of years ago, which was your potluck dinners traveling tour across the States. Fill us in on that. What was the story there?
Well, I got really kind of burned out on touring, like solo touring, because I did it for months and months and months back in the States. And to get somewhere, you drive all day, you show up, you sit in a not very nice green room, then you sound check, which is kind of horrible, and then you play your set to people who are usually just kind of getting tanked. And it's not particularly fun. So I made a list of all the things that I hated about touring, included all those things, and thought, how can I tour in a way that would just make me happy? Hmm. I was like, well, it would be cool if it was at someone's house, because I'm a bit of a homebody. I don't go out much. And it would be awesome if everybody brought food. And why don't we throw like a, you know, a good old-fashioned potluck and invite people to cook? And so I toured America and Canada, just showing up in people's living rooms. We'd sell tickets and everybody brought food. We ate dinner and it was amazing. It was great. And I'm actually, we're just starting to book another round of those for this summer.
And so how many dates did you do on this tour?
Maybe 60-something. Yeah, 60-something delicious dinners.
That's a lot of pasta salad.
Yeah, that it is. The funny thing was, is that would happen every time I played at a college town. There would be college students, they would all show up with like the same like macaroni and cheese and stuff, which is just funny.
And I want to scream, I want to burst, I want to blame the whole damn universe. But the same three words I whisper to myself. It's only dancing.
Let's just talk about Minneapolis, which is your sort of current hometown where you wrote and produced most of this album. Obviously, there's one name which everyone immediately goes to, which is Prince. What else, apart from Prince, what else is going on in Minneapolis musically? What does Minneapolis offer?
Minneapolis offers harsh, cold winters, and they're long. But, you know, this is kind of the time where everybody goes into the garage with their friends and drinks beer and forms bands. So, you know, we're not a particularly big city, but I think we box above our weight when it comes to the arts and music. And obviously Prince is the big thing, but we've had lots of bands. Semisonic was fairly well known over here, and Dan Wilson went on to write with Adele and actually produced my second record. There are so many bands. Polisa, Bon Iver, there's kind of a lot. And the fun thing is that it's actually small enough of a city that everybody ends up playing on everybody else's records. Like, we're not Chicago, we're not L.A. or New York or something. It's everybody helps everybody else with their own projects. So even in my credits there are people who play on, you know, or who are in a bunch of different bands in my band.
That was Jeremy Messersmith with Monocle's Paul Noble, and his new record, Heart Murmurs, is available on Glassnote Records. You can find out more at jeremymessersmith.com. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, we've looked at comics and cinema, comics and diplomacy, and we're just back from a slightly traumatic sting at the London Comic Con. But time to get serious. Can graphic novels achieve something more than entertainment? Well, that's what veteran war correspondent Patrick de Saint-Exupéry thinks. He's the editor of a quarterly magazine, La Revue 21, in Paris, which relies almost exclusively on drawings as opposed to photographs, and puts graphic novel reportage at the forefront of its editorial line. Why would drawings convey a story better than words or photos? We sent Monocle's Daphne Denny to the offices of 21 to find out.
Tintin had a quiff. Patrick de Saint-Exupéry has a cigarette, both on paper and in real life. Saint-Exupéry is very much a real person and one of France's most famous war correspondents, but he's also got a cartoon alter ego in a new graphic novel, Rwanda 1994, The Fantasy of Gods, illustrated by graphic artist Hippolyte, and written by himself.
The tragedy unfolding in the Central African nation of Rwanda keeps getting worse. UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali said today there is strong evidence that both sides in the vicious civil war are preparing new massacres of civilians. And he called for the use of force, large numbers of UN troops, to stop the slaughter.
Among the hundreds of thousands of innocent refugees who fled from Rwanda to Zaire are thousands of despicable war criminals, those with the blood of more than 500,000 victims on their hands.
We have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Alan, that's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
I've been working on a graphic novels on Rwanda's genocide. That was great because you have to find ways to make people understand what happens without trying to be describing too much, without avoiding the fascination for horror. If you're drawing your horror, you can't do that. It's just disgusting. And you have to find the ways to give the feeling of that.
The Fantasy of Gods is a tragic reflection on France's inaction during the genocide, but despite its subject, it features very few violent drawings. Instead, it's an autobiographical account of what it was like to be there as a reporter, and what it's like to go back now, knowing the role of France in one of the most horrendous crimes against humanity. And if most journalists have turned show don't tell into their motto, for Saint-Exupéry, the power of graphic novels over photojournalism is perhaps that you get to choose what you don't want to show.
Pictures are sometimes so limited to confront with the reality, they just give a part of the reality. And with an illustration, you just open your mind. Drawings can suggest a lot. And if you want to suggest too much, you're going to lose your reader.
Graphic novel reportage is very much the emphasis of Saint-Exupéry's quarterly magazine, La Revue 21. Since its launch in 2008, the magazine, which perhaps tellingly is only available in bookshops, not newsstands, features long-form articles and non-fiction graphic novels. While for this veteran journalist, it's only a natural extension of the most famous French-language comic book, which used to be published in newspapers as a serial, a feuilleton. Tintin, the work of Belgian illustrator Hergé.
Bonjour, madame. C'est bien ici qu'habitait Monsieur Balthazar?
Ah, oui, c'est ici. Oh, jeune homme, quel malheur, il était si poli. Vous êtes de la famille?
Non, je suis journaliste. J'aurais désiré jeter un coup d'œil dans sa chambre.
Oh, mais bien sûr, je vais vous la montrer. Venez, suivez-moi.
Graphic novel reportage was the idea of Hergé. When you just get back to comic story, Hergé in the beginning wanted to do a graphic story, but at that time it wasn't possible. No communication, no links, so long times. This is just obvious. Today it's possible. So let's do it. Let's try it. Let's make the dream of Hergé true.
Featuring works by some of the biggest names in the graphic novel world, the likes of Joe Sacco or Oliver Krugler, 21 explores the idea of art and journalism working alongside each other, a place where text is only there to fill the space between two images. The latest edition ends with a comic by Jean-Philippe Stassen about the tricky relationship between white artists in South Africa and the country's apartheid history. It includes some rather surprising references to an infamous rap band, The Antwoord, and their highly publicized fight with none other than Lady Gaga.
And here we have some local musicians about to kick some funky tunes.
Oh my God, look at their freaky fashion. I should get him to open for me.
Yo, that's Puff. Can I need to do that thing?
It's not in that graphic novel, it's not to speak about Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga is just a pretext. The principle is through that artistic group, in all the contradiction of the South African society, not all the South African society to be correct, but the white African society, all these progressist people who wanted a new Africa, which is right, but who now feel sometimes uncomfortable with what become that new Africa.
Perhaps better than any other form of reportage, graphic novels manage to grab the audience with a story that looks, but isn't fictional. Patrick de Saint-Exupéry just finished his cigarette and is rushing to light another one. He really is just like his cartoon alter ego. From Monaco, in Paris, I'm Daphné Denis.
Merci Daphné, and Revue 21 is out every 3 months and the April issue is in shops now.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion.
Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist. Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It started out as a free monthly comic and radio show in 2010, following the experiences of a school leaver coming to terms with life as a young person in Kenya. Supported by donor and corporate sponsorship, Shujaz FM has expanded across multiple platforms and picked up 2 international Emmys in the process. Written in Kenya's youth slang, its stories tell of everyday problems and offering practical advice are believed to have reached up to 6 million people. In Nairobi, Zoe Flood interviews some of the team at Shujaz FM.
I'm Rob Burnett, and I'm chief executive of Well Told Story. And we're the publisher of a comic book, among other things, here in Kenya. We started in about 2010 producing comics aimed at young Kenyans aged at 15 to 24 year olds mostly. We've distributed about 40 million copies of our comic book called Shujaz FM, which means Heroes FM. It's set around a guy called Boy, who's a 19-year-old school leaver. He finished high school last year, but he didn't make it into college and he didn't get a job. His mates have all cleared school with him. None of them got a job either, and they kind of started off with this thing called a self-help group, but it's rapidly changed into a vigilante gang. They'd like Boy to join, but he's refused so far because he's got a secret. And his secret is that he's built an FM radio station in his bedroom. And from there, he's able to hack into the frequencies of any radio station he likes with his daily show, Shujaz FM, Heroes FM. And his show is this call out to young people, step it up, come on, share stuff with me. And so the audience does, they send in their stories. And those stories are the ones that we end up picking up and putting back into the comic book, and actually then we have a whole online presence, and it's all about the conversations that go on between the DJ and the audience, and the audience, and the audience, and the audience.
I'm called Boy. People love me by DJB. Young people love DJB. They love him because they can identify with him. When young people from any corner of the country hears Shujaz or is reading the comic book, they see a reflection of their lives. There are so many people who don't have work to do, yet they are in that age where you leave your parents. You've been living under your parents, and they've been providing food, school fees, and all what you need. It's that time when you have to pack your belongings and go start your life. When you get a comic of Shujaz FM, like the one that I have in my hands, it has like almost everything. It's interesting, it is exciting. For someone who thinks they are bored, for people who think they are jobless, they can really, really get a lot from here. Call it entertainment, call it advice, call it message, call it anything you want. I think you can get from the comics.
It's Kenya's only comic book, really. And this month we'll print 750,000 copies. It's made right here in this team of young Kenyans who work on it all the time. We've got a bunch of guys aged 23, 24, 25 who put it together. And it's distributed free inside the national newspaper and free from the mobile phone company Safaricom's M-Pesa kiosks. So these are the kind of money transfer kiosks everywhere. So we reach all the corners of the country.
And why are telling these very real stories that affect young people in Kenya so important?
Because that's how people figure out their problems and their solutions. When we set out, we thought, let's find a way of reaching people who don't get information readily from any other reliable source. So people who are out of school, people who aren't in college, people who can't access the good ideas that are out there. So ideas about jobs and money, those are the key things that we begin with. I mean, actually, I say that. I think we begin with the idea of sex and money. Those that we construct our story around that. But really, it's about, how am I going to get on in life? There's some magic that resides in a comic. There's something amazing that happens in there. It's amazing because it's almost like listening to the radio, because you have to add the detail in your imagination that you don't get. But it's as powerful as TV, because you're offering people a visual version of the world that they can then fill in around. We are drawing the contemporary world that we find ourselves in East Africa. And I think that that's also important, because it's not really being done.
The team at Shoe Jazz FM, they're speaking to Zoe Flood. And finally, let's turn to a rather special birthday. Batman, who was first created by the legendary comic book illustrator Bob Keane for DC Comics in 1939, along with his caped sidekick Robin, of course, has been fighting the bad guys of Gotham City for 75 years. But there's one chapter of the Batman story that, until recently, remained untold. Between 1966 and 1967, DC Comics licensed the Batman character to the comic book artists in Japan, the first time, before or since, that illustrators in another territory could create their own versions of an American comic book character. The result was Batmanga, a short-lived but nonetheless intriguing melding of American pop culture aesthetics with manga, at a time when Japan was still rebuilding itself following the end of the Second World War, and following the years of American occupation that followed. Monocle's Thomas Lewis reports on how the untold story of what happened when Batman went to Japan.
Fighting crime in Gotham City for 75 years.
Surrender that gigantic pie. To the free, my rascally!
Batman's foes have been dastardly, devious, and downright bizarre. But there's one chapter of the Batman story that has, until now, been largely forgotten.
This really obscure phenomenon that happened in Japan in 1966 to 1967, in which the Japanese wrote and drew their own Batman stories. And it was not bootleg. It was legal and commissioned. They were the only country in the world to do that. Everybody else just translated the American stuff, but the Japanese created their own.
Chip Kidd is an illustrator based in New York City who has been a Batman fan for years.
As a Batman fan, to me, it was like finding a great Beatles record that had been recorded on tour in Japan and then kind of like shelved and then never released.
Get them, boys! Get them, or it's curtains!
It started by finding out that this even existed, which I did in the late 90s. So once we had enough collected, I took a meeting with the president of DC Comics at the time. That was the easy part. He looked at it and he was stunned. He didn't know it existed. Nobody there at the company knew it existed, and it wasn't in their archive. So he said, you know, this is amazing. We need to look into this legally to make sure that we still have the rights to it, which they did. And we can work out a licensing deal. But other than that, you're on your own. You've got to find all this yourself.
Those faces look awfully familiar, Batman.
You're right, Robin. I recognize three of them from the Gotham City police files.
I smell a rat.
Two rats, boy wonder. And guess who the cats are?
And find it all himself he did. Between 1966 and 1967, Japan produced its own series of Batman stories that saw Batman and Robin fighting crime in Tokyo. The artist behind the drawings was Kuwata Jiro, who is 79 years old. Like many Japanese comic artists in the 1960s, Kuwata Jiro began young. By the age of 14, he was already drawing comics professionally. But he remained elusive. After following a broken and sprawling paper trail, Chip Kidd says, he found him.
And basically he apologized to me, not to me, but he was sorry that he, quote, couldn't learn how to draw like an American. He just did it the way he knew how. And it's what to me is part of what makes it so beautiful.
And what he found was the iconic superhero rendered in manga, a style that was, by the 1960s, figuring out its own visual vocabulary.
Well, what's so interesting about it is you have this American icon, Batman is about as American as they come, being filtered through this aesthetic of Japan, and not only Japan, Japan in the 1960s. It's just really, it's hard to describe why it's so cool, but it's a great sort of blending of the two pop cultures.
Helen McCarthy is a historian of Japanese pop culture.
Japan was still very poor. It had been bombed to rubble.
It had very little working infrastructure. It was occupied by the Americans, who right up until they left in the 50s had been heavily censoring the whole of Japanese media.
But the greatest unofficial ambassador of goodwill has been the American soldier. Since the very beginning of the occupation, he has been in direct contact with the Japanese people themselves.
Japan was a society that had completely lost its sense of self. But suddenly, there in the 60s, there were all these wonderful things flooding in from the rest of the world with confidence and energy and enthusiasm. And Japanese kids, and Japanese particularly artists and creators, started to say, OK, we've had enough of apologising for the war. This is a new world. We're going to make Japan's place in it.
The shadow cast by the war lingered in Japan, from its living rooms to its businesses to its artists' workshops. And by the 1960s, Helen McCarthy says, it was in comic books that a sense of renewal could flourish.
But in pop culture that caters to kids, which is often considered the cheapest end of pop culture, there was an enormous enthusiasm for retelling and remaking stories. For example, all through the American censorship, most of the time the censors didn't bother to censor kids' comics because they were kids' comics. Who cares? And so a lot of really subversive stuff, a lot of very interesting retellings and psychological workings out of Japan's role in the war and Japan's defeat came through in kids' comics.
Batman's adventures in Japan may be a short-lived detour for one of the most famous crime fighters in comic book history. But for Chip Kidd, who spent a decade bringing Bat manga back to life, it's a footnote that deserves its own chapter in the comic hero's 75 years of fighting crime.
It's beautiful stuff. And it's also kind of the joy of seeing something that you're so used to in English in another language that then you recontextualize it in your head. And it helps you to enjoy it formally more.
For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Thank you, Tom. And that's all we have time for on today's show. Next week, British journalist Simon Heffer will give me a lesson on how to speak simply English and will be at the Berlin Biennale. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Daphne Denis for one last time, who we wish a hearty bon chance and au revoir to. And Holly Fisher will be stepping into the sexy kitten chasseur of Daphne next week. Now time for one last song from his Midori House session. Here is Jeremy Messersmith with I Wanna Be Your One Night Stand. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
I know I may not look like much. Guess the years have been a little rough. I'm not worried, no, I've got it planned. I wanna be your one night stand. We'll check into a dive motel. Carpet's worn and the curtains smell. TV's old, wallpaper bland. I wanna be your one night stand. Oh, we'll get drunk on a box of wine. Oh, making love underneath the vacancy sign. You don't have to meet my folks. I won't bore you with my stupid jokes. I'm just a guy with a minivan. I wanna be your one night stand. Oh, we'll get drunk on a box of wine. Oh, making love underneath the vacancy sign. So let's leave the kids at home. You wear that blouse, I'll wear cheap cologne. Throw away our wedding bands. I wanna be